Now, as you know, there are a number of ways you can tell us what you think of our program. You can send us an email or a letter, or you can post a comment on our website. Well, this may not come as much of a surprise, but people who leave comments on the internet can be really, really, really mean. Blogs and news websites, including ours, have seen more than their fair share of nasty responses and name-calling. NPR's Laura Seidel reports that some sites are reconsidering just how open they really want to be.
If you want to know what it's like to get attacked online, just ask Mikey Shu Levy. She wrote a thankful letter to the editor of the local paper when the health care bill passed. She has lupus. Her 24-year-old son can't get health care because of a pre-existing heart condition, and her husband was diagnosed with liver cancer.
So my thank you note was really about the relief I had mentally.
When Levy looked at the site the morning it was posted, she got comments like this one.
Oh, my poor baby is sick. Only the great Obama can save him. Makes me sick just reading it.
Levy was shocked by the vitriol.
And I'm going, oh my gosh, I can't believe what they're saying. Oh my goodness, this is so personal. I mean, I guess I wrote a personal story, so maybe that's what I asked for.
The Napa Valley Register, which published Levy's letter, wouldn't comment about her experience. But some sites like having personal attacks, says Scott Rosenberg, author of Say Anything, How Blogging Began.
What they really wanted was to boost traffic on their websites because the more pages that are viewed, the more ads can be sold.
Rosenberg says it was just part of the early zeitgeist of the web to let commenters say whatever they wanted.
So many media companies simply opened the doors to their websites and said, anybody come post whatever you want, and expected that they would have brilliant conversations and exchanges of ideas.
There might be a few of those, but too often it's the nasty comments that jump out. Stanford Communications Professor Clifford Nass says it's predictable when you have a lot of people vying for attention.
So ironically and tragically, if you want people to respond to what you say, say something outrageously negative.
And there's been some high-profile negativity on big sites like CNN.com. Lila King, a senior producer there, says during the last presidential election, a commenter kept putting up the same image.
It's a little cartoon of a white stick figure and a black stick figure, and the white stick figure with a machine gun in its hand shooting the other stick figure and its heart exploding and red splatters all over the page.
It isn't just the big sites. It's the little blogs and specialty sites like Religion Dispatches. The site has long-form articles that look at the places where religion and politics meet. Many of the writers are scholars and academics. Editor Lisa Webster says an article written by an expert on Islam got some terrible comments.
Someone from our funder noticed and said, by the way, we're not interested in funding, you know, providing a platform for hate speech.
Webster began to worry that the open comments were detracting from the thoughtful tone of Religion Dispatches.
It's also like old magazine days. You don't, if you're doing a restaurant review, you don't put the restaurant review next to an ad for a garbage dump or something like that. You have to think about these things.
Religion Dispatches has a radical solution. They're getting rid of comments. Readers have to send a letter to the editor. It can be an email, but only a few of the best letters get published.
I think we're going to lose traffic. I'm hoping it'll be sort of a dip. The roller coaster will dip, and then it'll tick back up eventually.
But some sites want to clean up the comments and still maintain a fast-paced response to events. Tom Mallory, the content director for the San Diego Union-Tribune's website, says recently they posted a headline that got his users mad. It was about a man who was murdered by a couple of guys who were spray-painting a wall.
The headline, unfortunately, referred to graffiti artists, which made it seem that they were, you know, Van Gogh with a spray can.
Many users accused the Union-Tribune of having a political agenda.
I waded in, said, it's a good point, I'll fix the headline. Someone asked another question about why it was written, and the readers started kind of answering it and discussing among themselves, accepting my explanation. It was a valuable reader exchange. I'm glad it happened.
Mallory says this helped him see the value of having someone on the staff take part in the conversation. But he says they don't always have the staff available. The Union Tribune is one of many sites that are using technology.
With software, you can ban certain words and phrases, and in fit of piques, as I've done, gone through the site and found every combination of characters that make nasty words and ban those characters, ban those phrases.
Mallory also thinks that anonymity is a problem. The software lets the paper track users, keep a record of their comments, and ban them. According to the makers of the software called Discuss, their 2-year-old product is now being used by 350,000 websites. But Lila King of CNN.com says her commenters have never been anonymous, yet they still had a problem. At CNN.com, they decided the solution is to have a real live person curate the comments and take part in the discussions.
Really, it's the human touch. It's actually staying inside the conversation and being active and highlighting comments that we think editorially are really interesting or significant. Set the tone for what you hope the conversation will be.
If the conversation had been more civil when Mikey Shu Levy sent her a letter about healthcare, she says she wouldn't mind if people had a different point of view.
I think it would be wonderful if we could challenge people who really disagree to have a really great conversation about it. Say a very lively Democrat and a very lively Republican, but really truly be real in what you're discussing.
If all these changes, both technical and personal, raise the level of discussion, many sites are hoping more people will feel comfortable joining in the conversation instead of just watching it explode. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Facebook says it will let users reclaim some of the privacy options they've lost in recent months. The social networking giant announced yesterday it's simplifying its privacy controls. Company founder Mark Zuckerberg says it's in response to feedback from users. But as NPR's Martin Costi reports, Facebook has also been feeling pressure from Washington.
It's one thing for Mark Zuckerberg to get trashed on a privacy blog. It's quite another for him to receive a letter on U.S. Senate stationery.
We clearly got their attention.
That's Senator Mark Begich of Alaska, one of the four senators who wrote to Zuckerberg last month, telling him they were concerned about Facebook's privacy practices. Begich says Facebook paid attention.
They've moved, at least from their earlier position of, we don't have to do anything, we're Facebook, and this is what we do.
This summer, Congress will consider an update to internet privacy laws, and online services like Facebook are worried about tighter regulations. Even if Congress doesn't act, the Federal Trade Commission has leeway to set new privacy rules. But William McGovern, a law professor who specializes in internet privacy, says Facebook's new policies may buy it some goodwill in Washington.
My guess is that it will at least take off some of the strongest heat that they've felt.
Senator Begich agrees, saying congressional action on Facebook is probably on hold for now. Martin Costi, NPR News.
Now to a man who's trying to fend off a mutiny among his 400 million clients. He's the man behind Facebook, the 26-year-old founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg. Yesterday, he announced a new privacy system that will simplify how users can control who sees their information. That new policy came after weeks of increasingly angry protest from Facebook users who complained that the social networking site was disclosing personal data to third parties. Mark Zuckerberg joins us from Facebook headquarters in Palo Alto. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing these protests getting louder and louder. There's a We're Quitting Facebook campaign on the net. Did this level of user anger catch you off guard?
You know, whenever we launch products, a lot of people like the products. And a lot of people are critical. And I think that that's just something that comes with having more than 400 million people using your service. So what we try to do is we try to build the products that we think are best. And then we listen to what people are saying, how people are talking to their friends about the product, what they tell us, you know, the emails they send us. What we heard loud and clear this time was that people wanted simpler controls for how they share their information. We spent the last few weeks building those. It was a pretty big effort, but we really wanted to make sure that we were responding to the feedback that we were hearing. So that's what we rolled out.
Let's tick through some of the nuts and bolts about how this is going to work. I am a Facebook member. I haven't gotten any message yet about the new policy or how to change my settings. When is this going into effect?
So we started rolling it out yesterday, and we want to make sure that the launch goes smoothly. So we're going to be rolling it out over the next few days to a week. And after a week from now, everyone will have the new settings.
Okay, and if right now there are about 170 different privacy options, maybe 50 privacy settings, how many will there be under the new system?
Well, there's one main setting that controls all of the content that you share on a day-to-day basis on Facebook. If you want to use all of the granular settings that you had before, for each individual piece of information, those are all still there because a lot of people really enjoyed them. But what we heard was that people really just wanted a simple control that they could turn to, and that's what we really invested in building here.
One control. You're saying I can click on one thing and it will change all of my settings if I want it to.
For all the content that you share, all your photos, status updates, and all the day-to-day content that you're sharing on the site.
Here's the most common complaint that I've heard. I actually sent a message out on Facebook to ask for questions. People are saying, why not make privacy the default setting? In the new system, you're still going to have to actively choose if you want to opt out of sharing information. Instead, why not have people actively choose to opt in if they want to share it publicly? And otherwise, their privacy will be protected.
When people ask, why don't we have the most restrictive settings? I think what they're asking is, why don't we set things to be visible to friends only by default? And the answer to that is that Facebook has always just been about friends and community. So that's why. There's this false rumor that's been going around, which says that we're sharing private information with applications. And it's just not true. The way it works is, if you choose to share some information with everyone on the site, then that means that any person can go look up that information, and any application can go look up that information as well. So some applications can access the information that you've already made visible to everyone, but applications have to ask for permission for anything that you've set to be private. The rumors that have been going around that say that that people are sharing information, their private information, with applications are actually just not true.
When we talk about applications, we're talking maybe about games, Farmville, things like that. But if you haven't actively shut that off, they're getting that information, right?
If you say that something is visible to everyone, then that means that any person or any application can go see it. But if you decided, for example, that you want your photos to only be visible to your friends or your family, then that means that no one is going to be able to see it, and no applications are going to be able to see that without asking for permission first.
Mr. Zuckerberg, aren't there pretty significant revenue implications here for Facebook? The more data that you're able to share with third parties or advertisers, the more valuable you are to them. That data is really gold in your universe.
You know, this is actually a really big misperception, too. We don't share any information with advertisers. The way the system works is that advertisers come to us and tell us what they want to advertise, and we are able to show their ads to the people we think are going to be most interested. But since we're targeting the ads ourselves, at no point during that process do advertisers actually get access to the information. If you're asking, you know, how do we make money? We really make money when people enjoy using the service, right? When people share information with their friends, then they're on the service, and then there's the ability for us to show them ads. But, you know, we think about that more as, if we provide value for people, then we'll also be able to build a good company. But the primary thing that we focus on all day long is how to help people share and stay connected with their friends, family, and the people in the community around them. That's what we care about, and that's why we started the company.
Well, Mark Zuckerberg, thanks for talking to us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Mark Zuckerberg is the founder and CEO of Facebook. It's no secret that Apple's stock has skyrocketed. Yesterday, for the first time, all of Apple's shares were worth more than all of Microsoft's. Well, that got us thinking about Apple investments, something that Kyle Conroy has also been thinking about. He's a computer science major at UC Berkeley, and he has compiled a table that answers this question.
How much money would you have today if you'd purchased Apple stock instead of an Apple product? And Kyle Conroy joins us now by Skype. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So let's just tick through some of these. Let's take a PowerBook G4 with a 17-inch screen. That's a pretty coveted item when it came out back in January of 2003. And the price then was $3,299. And if you had instead invested that in Apple stock, how much would it be worth right now?
You would have $120,000. Pretty impressive.
And let's take, let's say, another product, something perhaps a little bit smaller in value, the iPod Mini.
The asking price back in February of 2004 was $249. And if you hadn't purchased that iPod Mini, if you had instead purchased Apple stock, how much would you have in the bank right now?
You would have $6,103.
Again, another fine return on that investment. Now, do you have any of these products?
I bought both the original iPod, and I currently own a 15-inch MacBook Pro from about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So if you were smart and you'd purchased Apple stock, you'd have a lot of money. But what about the opportunity cost?
Definitely. I'm a computer science major. My laptop is very, very important to me. So this computer has gotten through me a lot of stuff.
Kyle Conroy is a junior at UC Berkeley, and you can find a link to his blog post, "Should I Have Bought That Apple Product?" at our website, npr.org. Kyle, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
If you're kicking yourself right now over not having bought that Apple stock back in 2003, well, you're not alone. To try to sort some things out, we've asked Robert Benincasa of NPR's investigative unit to look at a few other products. And Robert's here in the studio. Hello.
Hello, Michelle.
Now, you specialize in digging through all kinds of data, and you've pulled together some numbers for us. Can we start with Apple's rival, Microsoft?
Sure. Let's go back to Windows 98. When it came out, it was about $89. And if you had taken that $89 and instead bought Microsoft stock, you'd have today about $85.
You would have lost money.
You've lost about $4, not counting all of the other losses from inflation and such like that. And, Michelle, these are back-of-the-envelope kinds of calculations. They don't take into consideration commissions to buy and sell stock, the taxes that you pay, dividends, and things like that. We're just kind of looking at the value of the stock.
Let's look at a John Deere lawnmower, big ticket item, a lot of money there. What'd you find?
Right. Well, let's go back a decade. In 2000, if I had spent $500 on a John Deere lawnmower, and I like this example because I don't like mowing the lawn, and instead I took that money and I bought John Deere stock, I'd have about $1,400 in stock right now, 10 years later.
And you'd probably have to use some of that money to pay somebody else to mow your lawn because your grass wouldn't be looking really good. How about cars? Let's say you bought a Ford Taurus.
Well, you know, cars depreciate over time, but we put up with that because we enjoy them. So if you bought a Ford Taurus in 2000 for $18,000, right now the car would be worth about $2,000. The stock, $18,000 back then, right now would be worth about $7,000.
Okay, so that's one example. What if you purchased a Buick?
Well, as we know, GM was delisted from the stock exchange, and the news there is kind of grim. The stock for General Motors is worth almost nothing right now, so you'd be better off with the car.
Okay, so if you're driving a Buick right now, you have a smile on your face
exactly.
As you're listening to this conversation.
Enjoy the car.
Robert Benincasa, always good to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Robert Benincasa is with NPR's investigative unit.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where the good folks here at Tell Me More lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blog universe and get to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here. Lee, what's up?
Hey, Tony. The other day, a group of us were up in New York to support our host, Michelle Martin, as her family memorialized her only brother, Norman McQueen Jr. Now, as folks know, she's been away for a couple of weeks dealing with Norman's death. Norman, or Wade, or Mac as he was sometimes called, took his own life recently. Michelle briefly dropped by the studio to deliver this gripping commentary about her brother's life and death.
Now, I know some people think taking your own life is a selfish act, but I cannot bring myself to see it that way. I see it as selfless, in the sense that you come to believe yourself has no value, that everybody would be better off without you. I think my brother thought he was a failure, that with his long bout of unemployment, he could not live up to what was expected of him as a man, and that we'd all be better off without him. He was so wrong.
And Tony, after that commentary, we were flooded with comments. Hundreds of people wrote on our website and emailed us directly to express their condolences and support for Michelle. But Tony, many people also wrote to tell us how they too have been affected by the suicide of a loved one. For instance, here's what we heard from listener Erica.
I lost my boyfriend, Jeff, to suicide on February 13th, 2010, and I have a tremendous understanding for how painful this is. I, too, believe that suicide is not a selfish act. My boyfriend, like your brother, was a beautiful, caring, and unbelievably loving soul, the very antithesis of selfishness. Your story inspires me to share more about Jeff to others. I am so sorry for your loss.
Thanks a lot for that, Erica. And we also received this note from blogger CM. He writes, I've about given up looking for employment. I'm facing losing everything I've worked for, and I'm on the last tank of gas I can afford. I'm just about in the same position Norman was in, complete despair. I seem to keep thinking, what would life be like without me around? The commentary, he says, made me think of things I hadn't thought of and just maybe saved me from doing something I and I know my loved ones would regret.
Well, thanks, CM, and all the best to you. And Tony, I caught up with Dr. Carl Bell, as we sometimes do, for advice on tough matters like this. He's a professor of public health and psychiatry at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And Dr. Bell offered this advice for our listeners.
There are four things psychiatrists usually recommend to people before life takes a downward turn. Prepare for stress, that people, when they're in that distressful, horrible situation, they take a little break from that stress because it's hard to make decisions when you're upset. And then once you've taken that break, you've got two choices. You can either change the inside, that is, change how you feel about what's happening to you, or you can try to change the outside by doing something active and constructive. If you're the surviving relative of somebody that's committed suicide, you can't change that when you've kind of recovered from the grief that you're going to experience. You can take that horrible circumstance and use it as motivation, maybe to get involved with some suicide prevention activities. So the anecdote for learned helplessness is learned helpfulness.
Thanks, Dr. Bell. And thank you, Lee.
Thank you, Tony.
And we should mention to listeners that if you do find yourself in distress and need someone to talk to, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-23-TALK. Again, 1-800-237-8255.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. If you're like me, you know, when you watch any of these nature TV shows on television and you sit there, don't you wonder to yourself, how did they do that? How do they get that shot? Just as the humpback whale is jumping out of the water, they got it. Or the lion chasing down some sort of prey, they got it. Or how do they get high up in the canopy where those monarch butterflies are and actually get a camera up there to show the butterflies? Well, this hour, I hope to get you some answers from someone who knows. Mike Gunton is the executive producer of the gorgeous 11-part Life series that aired on the BBC and on the Discovery Channel here in the States. All sorts of creatures, or insects and plants included, have their 15 minutes of fame, sort of speak, on screen in the series that documents the struggle for survival. The series is now out on DVD, and Mike Gunton joins us from our NPR West studios. Thanks for talking with us today.
Pleasure. Nice to be here.
I know that your specialty are the butterflies, right?
Well, I went on that that shoot because I'm the executive producer. I usually end up spending far too much time in the office. But I did say on this then sometimes, right, I'm going on that shoot. And I did go on that one, which was great fun.
And we have actually a clip of the making of the Monarch segment on our website at sciencefriday.com if you want to see, go behind the scenes and see the. I didn't realize, and this answers the question, how did they get that shot? You have pulleys and ropes and all kinds of stuff to get a camera up and out of the trees on sort of remote control.
It was a pretty ramshackle thing that, you know, a lot of the equipment we have is incredibly sophisticated, incredibly expensive. But this was actually, yeah, pretty ramshackle. It was effectively a cable tied at one end of a tree and tied right up at the top of the other. And a camera hung on a carriage, which had two big bicycle wheels and with lead in the rims to act as gyroscopes. And then a rope goes up to the top of the tree. A big bag of rocks is attached to that. And you just kind of drop the bag of rocks and hope that the weight of it is roughly the same as the camera. And up goes the camera and it flies through the air and flies amongst the butterflies and gives you that kind of amazing view of what it's like to be a butterfly.
And you did it on the first take, right?
You've seen the makeup. Okay. 17th take it was, actually. We didn't get the number of rocks right.
Is that typical? In the nature?
It can be. So it depends. I mean, of course, in nature, some things just happen once, and that's you can't ask an animal to go and do a retake. But when you're doing stuff with kit, with weird equipment, that is often when it does tend to go wrong. Because, you know, you're taking stuff out into the middle of nowhere, right, and the humidity and the bumpy ride and the dust, and often this stuff is stuff we've, as I say, we kind of put together ourselves with bits of gaffer tape and string.
Right. If you're waiting for like a bug to run by and you don't quite get the shot, do you pick the bug up and put him back in that spot?
I couldn't possibly say. No, I mean, it depends what's happening. I mean, I'm sure that does happen. But, you know, the thing about behavior, this series is very much about trying to get extraordinary animal behavior, things that you see animals doing that you don't normally see them doing. And mm-hmm. one of the reasons why we don't do that is because if you interfere with them, they just sit there and go, I'm not going to do that. And so you have to let nature kind of let animals get on with their own lives. Otherwise, they won't do stuff. So we have this kind of rule of a line over which we will tend not to tread. We'd like to get close because we like to get the cameras in their kind of world. But if you step over that line, then they either run away, fly off, or sulk.
And of course, I'm sure you've been asked, what was the most difficult thing to film in the series?
Well, it depends. I think you mentioned humpback whales. We did do a sequence with humpback whales, which I think right. was probably logistically one of the toughest, because anything to do with the sea, anything to do with working in the ocean is always adds that extra. Doing things at night, doing things in caves, and doing things in the ocean are kind of treble the amount of aggro, the difficulty. And this was tough because, for a start, the animals had one thing on their – those male humpbacks had just one thing on their mind, and that was that female that they were chasing. And they, you know, you think of whales as being gentle giants, but these males were completely crazed, sex crazed, and they were swimming five or six times faster than they would normally swim, absolutely going hell for leather after this female. And we wanted to film it from the water level, from a boat. We also wanted to film it from above because there's a kind of a battle going on. It's basically the biggest bar brawl in nature, because these males are crashing into each other and hitting them with each other with their fins and trying to push each other under and blowing bubbles at each other. And to get the sense of the craziness and the mayhem, we wanted to be right above them in a helicopter shooting down. Mm-hmm. But we also wanted to get in the water with them and get a sense of what was going on in the undersea world. And that was probably the trickiest and I'd say the most challenging bit for the crew, even though that's normally the least challenging, because, you know, that's we do that quite a lot. But it was because the speed they were swimming at and because of their craziness, and the cinematographer, he couldn't use scuba tanks. He could only do it by freediving, holding his breath.
Oh, no kidding.
No, because the bubbles that he produces, because they're so sensitive to the sound of bubbles, because they're using them to threaten each other, the sound of the bubbles coming out of his scuba would have put them off. So right. That's a good example of what I was saying. And so he had to swim. We zip up in a boat, drop him in the water, takes a deep breath, swims down, takes his shots, pops up to the surface again. We grab him, drop him, you know, so it was a kind of a leapfrogging ahead of him as he was going. Mm-hmm. And he said it was like standing on a freeway with 10 trucks coming towards him at full speed, and the drivers had their eyes shut whilst he was having to hold his breath.
Wow, playing chicken with humpback whale.
It was exactly that.
Wow. And if you want to see a clip, we have actually on our website at sciencefriday.com, we have a behind-the-scenes clip of making of that whale segment. So we'll go to sciencefriday.com if you want to see it. Did you ever use tiny little cameras? You're in so small spots sometimes filming those insects. Are they tiny cameras, or they just look like you can get in a tiny space with them?
No, they are tiny cameras, actually. One of the things that the big advances in high definition have really allowed us to step into that miniature world, because, you know, traditionally natural history programs tend to concentrate on the bigger animals.
Right.
And we were very keen to kind of say, well, hold on, if you can actually film the smaller creatures like we would film the big creatures, maybe there's a whole dramatic new world to show people. And that was one of our aims on the series. And you're right, little tiny lenses. Sometimes those lenses, we've even filed the bottom off them so we can actually get them as the camera. Rod Clark, who's one of the cameramen on it, was talking about this yesterday and saying, you know, he tries to get the camera at the eye level of the bug, or sometimes below its knees. So wow. You get that sense you're in its world. And they're tiny little but very sensitive cameras. And so it gives you a nice depth of field, and you really feel that creature is in its environment.
Yeah, those little insects, the sequence where the frog, his tongue is flashing out to capture the insects.
Yeah, the damsel flies.
Amazing. Yeah. And I love the one where he misses it.
Exactly. I mean, we love that shot, because it just shows, animals don't get it right. And he's so hopeful. He jumps up and he throws his tongue out and he grabs what he thinks is the mayfly. And then he grabs it thin air because he thinks he's caught it. And, of course, the damselfly is thrown off and said, ha-ha, well, escaped you.
For we geeks in the audience, how many frames per second, how fast is that running to get that kind of incredible slow motion on it?
The fastest... One of the big advantages of this new high-definition technology is that we can, in the old days, it was a real struggle to get to these very high frame rates with film. Mm-hmm. But we can now go up to 2,000 frames a second. Now, theoretically, we can go higher than that, but it starts to get quite tricky in terms of actually downloading the data from it. Because these cameras are not really cameras. They're taking files. They're almost like computers, just like taking zillions of stills and then dumping them onto a big hard drive. So it's not very user-friendly. We have to have lots of wires and stuff when we're doing these kind of shots. But the results are amazing.
And and all this is out on DVD now, correct?
Yep. There's two versions of the DVD coming out on this Tuesday coming, June 1st. A standard DVD, and there's also a Blu-ray, which I must say I personally think is incredible. I saw the Blu-ray back home, and there was stuff on there that I hadn't seen. I've seen every frame of this series hundreds of times, and I was seeing stuff on that Blu-ray. Well, that I thought, I haven't seen that before. That's amazing.
Well, there are actually two versions of this. There's the your side of the pond version and our side of the pond version.
Oh no, yeah, but there is. There's four versions.
Oh, there's four versions. Like,
because there's a standard there's a standard DVD, and then there's a Blu-ray.
Right. Well,
DVD.
My point being that you have different narrators.
Yeah,
Oprah Winfrey is the American version.
Yeah, and then there's also for each of those, there's also a David Attenborough version, which is the version that we did for the airing in the UK, and then there's Oprah's version, which we did for the airing on Discovery.
Mm-hmm. Now, the two things I picked out that I wanted to ask you about. One is in all this nature. 11 different programs, we don't hear the word evolution hardly mentioned anywhere. Was that just for the American audience that you left that out?
No, I don't think so. No, I mean, this series is actually all about evolution, but I suppose it's with a small e rather than a big e. I mean, what you're seeing is kind of evolution in action, because a lot of this behavior is right at the cutting edge of these animals pushing their boundaries. And, for example, there's a sequence with dolphins where you would describe that as cultural evolution. They're inventing a piece of behavior which if it is successful and raises their fitness, then they will that improves their chances, then that behavior will probably get passed on to the next generation and will become part of their behavioral repertoire. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, or if those particular dolphins kind of forget it, then it'll disappear. So evolution, we felt that we were looking at snapshot of evolution happening at these little the shoot tips of the tree of life.
Yeah. And one other little bone to pick, and maybe you'll explain this to me, as a fish myself, when I'm underwater, I never hear any of those watery sounds, the splashing and gurgling that seem to be going on. when your fish are underwater, that's got to be put in later.
Well,
right?
We do, but we do record underwater.
Yes.
Of course, but you can't record these things in synchronized, in other words, at the same time. But we have amazing hydrophones and stuff, and we do record sounds underwater, including, in fact, somebody wrote into us and was rather snootily saying something about we'd stuck some submarine sonar sounds over this a seal called a Weddell seal under the water. And it gave me great pleasure to be able to write back to him to say, actually, these are the sounds. The first time anybody's recorded these sounds, we recorded them on a hydrophone. We took these hydrophones all the way to Antarctica. We dug a hole in the ice. We stuck it under the ice and we recorded these sounds. So there.
I got to tell you, I did that in 1979.
What, you went to Antarctica?
Yes. I recorded those amazing Weddell seals.
Oh, you didn't?
Yes, I did.
Oh, sorry. Oh, okay. Well, maybe it wasn't the first time.
At McMurdo.
That's where we were.
I know, and they were amazing sounds. I couldn't believe seals were making them. Thank you very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you.
Mike Gunn is the executive producer of this gorgeous 11-part series, Life. It's out there in DVD and also on Blu-ray. I'm going to get my Blu-ray copy because I'm going to buy one of those and see what it's so pretty to look at. We'll see what Blu-ray looks like. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to switch gears, and we're going to talk about the Memorial Day. What is it? Summertime. Well, what is summertime for you? It's all kinds of outdoors things. So we'll start off with talking about birds and their eggs and stuff like that. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News.